Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, virtual reality. When an ancient temple site was restored in Phi Mai, Thailand, the historians came to Dr. Richard Levy at the University of Calgary. He recreated the entire site in cyberspace. A virtual tour on the computer not only promotes the historic site, it also protects it from the degradation that inevitably comes from real tourist traffic. And the Emerald Awards. Last week, the Emerald Foundation for Environmental Excellence celebrated its 10th anniversary with an award ceremony in Calgary. We'll meet the finalists in the research and innovation category. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta.
These early 20th century photographs reveal the condition of the site before reconstruction.
What you're hearing is the soundtrack from a computer animation. It's a virtual reality trip inside and all around an ancient temple site in Phi Mai, Thailand. After the site was restored a few years ago, Dr. Richard Levy, an associate professor in urban planning at the University of Calgary, was invited to recreate the complete site on the computer. As I sit down in front of the computer screen in Richard's office, the animation begins and we are transported through cyberspace to the grounds of this magnificent temple.
The temple site is located in Phi Mai, which is north of Bangkok in Thailand, and is not too far away from Siem Reap in Cambodia. It's an important temple site because it was a center of religious and military activity in the 8th to 12th century.
What are we looking at now?
We're looking at a wireframe model of the site in Phi Mai, and that means just the geometry. And as we go through the animation, you will see it be transformed from the wireframe to what we call a shaded view, so you can see all the planes, all the geometric planes. And then this is the rendered view with all the texture maps, so you can actually get a sense of what the structure actually looks like.
Now, you went all the way over there. What did you find when you got there?
Well, it's a very interesting site. For those out there listening to this program, if you've been to Siem Reap and had an opportunity to look at Angkor Wat, this is a miniature version of one of the temple sites in Siem Reap, and it's a fairly well-reconstructed site. It's a series of gated and walled enclosures, and at the very center is a quite a remarkable sanctuary that is about 30 meters to the height, which is a very elaborate and adorned domed structure.
Now, what's the purpose of the virtual reconstruction? It's almost like you're visiting the place.
Well, that's exactly what the purpose is. The idea was that if we could develop this computer model and produce animation and potentially even a virtual environment, then we could have people view this at a distance and be interested in perhaps coming there to visit the site. And as tourists, of course, there'd be the benefit of the operators in the area economically benefiting from that visitation. So ultimately, it was to promote tourism. But since we've been working on this project, we came to the realization it would be a very useful vehicle for looking at various interpretations of the site as well.
Now, I would think that it would be fairly fragile after being reconstructed like that.
Well, the actual site is somewhat fragile. It's red sandstone, and red sandstone is not a very strong material. So these virtual models have the potential in the future of protecting the actual site, because people can visit it virtually, and maybe they won't have to visit the entire site. They could just see that portion of it that can be protected from excessive wear. I think this is a real problem, because in many parts of the world, with the growth of tourism, these sites will be subject to great wear with all the tourists walking through them and touching them. They're quite fragile with that many visitors.
Now, the thing that's really striking about looking at the pictures as they go by on the computer is how beautiful and magnificent the site itself is. But at the same time, I'm just absolutely astounded at the amount of work that must have been involved in actually putting this virtual program together. What did you have to do?
Well, it's a process that's a little bit like building a real model of the site. You start with plans and elevation drawings, and from that you extract the geometry. And in a computer-aided design application, we call a CAD application, we actually build the geometry of the walls and the gates and the temple sanctuary. And you're actually, in a sense, building this structure as if you were on the site, one piece at a time. Once the geometry has, in a sense, been carved in electronic clay, we then apply images to the surfaces of these geometric forms. Now, these images can come from photographs, or they can come from drawings, and they can be edited inside image editing programs like Photoshop, and we can then take those images and apply them to the actual surface of the geometry which makes up the temple site. And so when you actually view it on the computer, it actually looks like the temple at Pimai.
How long would it take to put something like this together?
Well, many people are familiar with all the special effects that they see in the movies and on TV. It's very simple to create a model, but then you have to generate each image that makes up an animation. And when you're viewing a film or a video, those images are going by at 30 frames a second. So each image has to be, in a sense, rendered out of the computer model and then compiled in a video editing program to make the actual animation or video. So if you have 10 seconds, that's 300 frames. It's not unusual, as in this case, to take 2 to 3 minutes just to generate a single frame. So I'm sure our listeners can do the calculation. It can take literally days to render out a sequence that lasts a couple of minutes. But this isn't unusual in computer animation.
Now, this is one site. Are there further applications for the type of work that you've done here?
Well, we hope to be able to use this technology in other locations. And in fact, the technology is advancing every day. One of our hopes is to use 3D scanning technology to actually go to the site and create a virtual copy of the monument. This would be accurate to a fraction of a millimeter. And in this way, you would have a electronic copy in three-dimensional space of the temple site. Now, you might ask, why would that be useful? Well, one reason you would want to have such a model is that then you could compare future three-dimensional scans with the one that we have today as a baseline. So you could actually determine where wear is occurring, where pieces suddenly have disappeared, if indeed there's settlement in the structure where it's occurred, so that structural enhancement can take place in the overall complex. So there's great reason for doing these kinds of three-dimensional scans. And then you could take that same geometry and bring it into a virtual world, and people could experience it anywhere in the world, hopefully. And you could use it for archaeological exploration and discovery. I think there's a lot of possibilities if this would come about in the future.
Now, some of the funding for this has come from something called MACI. What's that?
MACI is the Multimedia Advanced Computational Infrastructure, and it's been supporting researchers like myself here at the University of Calgary by providing them with hardware, software, and technical assistance in the development of multimedia and advanced visualization applications in scientific and social science research. And so they've been very supportive in terms of helping me out with hardware and software. But I also like to mention another means of support for this project, which was AIT and UEM in Bangkok. Professor Walter Jameson is the director of the Urban Environmental Management Program, and without his support, this project would never have come about.
Well, one of the other interesting things about this project is that it's becoming recognized throughout the world. You're off on a number of shows, and you've won awards. What are some of the awards that this project has gotten?
Well, this will be screened at SIGGRAPH 2001 in Los Angeles, California, in August this year. And SIGGRAPH is a conference where people who are interested in computer animation and rendering and modeling get together once a year to show off their work. And my work will be shown along with some of the big animation studios like Industrial Light and Magic and Pixar. So I feel quite privileged to be able to show my work in Los Angeles at SIGGRAPH 2001 this year. I'll also be showing my video at the Vancouver Island Film Festival in August, and it will also appear as part of an exhibit sponsored by Canadian Architect later in June and July. So a number of things have come up, and we're all real happy that this has come about.
And actually, that June and July one, that's in Edmonton.
That's right. That's in Edmonton, and the images from the model will be published in Canadian Architect, the June edition.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you very much.
I was speaking with Dr. Richard Levy, an associate professor of urban planning and design at the University of Calgary. You, too, can take a cyber tour of the PMI Temple. The web address is www.pmai.ca, and I'll spell that, it's PHIMAI.ca. Coming up, a night at the Emerald Awards.
The next Emerald Award is presented in the category of research and innovation. You know, in the larger scheme of things, there is no such thing as a failed experiment. It can always be used as a bad example for those who follow it.
Since 1992, the Emerald Foundation for Environmental Excellence has been recognizing people across Alberta who devote their time and efforts to preserving or improving the environment around us. Last Monday, I attended the awards ceremony in Calgary and had a chance to meet the three finalists in the research and innovation category. First was Yasha Kalra. He's a soil chemist with the Canadian Forest Service based in Edmonton. His work helped establish standards for the Association of Official Analytical Chemists on the testing of soil pH. This is particularly important regarding the effect of acid rain on our forests.
What I did is AOAC publishes a book called OMA, Official Methods of Analysis. It's published every 5 years. 1955 was the last edition which had methods on soil analysis. And then I did this study, and in 1995, so after a period of 40 years, now soils methods are in the OMA, Official Methods of Analysis, and I'm fortunate to be the first person after all these years whose collaborative study is included in the book.
What exactly did you do in your study?
What I did was pH is the most important property of soil, and we did not have any validated method. There are many methods for pH. So if a person does pH in Guatemala and he gets 5.3 reading, and you get a reading in Calgary, 5.1, is that the same method they're using? Or if you get 4.2, for example, and you say the pH was 4.2 and the guy there says it's 5.3, there's a vast difference, but the thing is, did you use the same method? So what we're doing is, we did a study in which we compared four different methods for pH, and we sent the samples around the world to about 60 labs, and then we sent the samples to them, and we gave them these four methods, and the labs were asked to do analysis according to these methods.
Was there anything really special that you had to do in order to balance it out so that everybody could come up with the same answer?
Well, one thing that AOAC does is when we compare these methods, it's called collaborative study. And one of the most important things is we write a protocol which has to be approved by AOAC and the Soil Science Society of America because it's a collaborative study. And main criteria is that each step should be indicated. So if you're going to do pH, we don't say just take soil sample and add water and take a reading. No, you will give exact details. Take so many grams of sample, transfer into such a container, add so many milliliters of water, shake it for so long. You will give each step the way you want each lab to participate in. And what happens at the end when the lab send you results, if for some reason they didn't follow the method exactly the way you said, then it remarks, they will give you the variation. If it's at 25 degrees and for some reason they did at 20 degrees or 21 degrees, so they will indicate that in remarks. That way, if there is any variation results, this information will be useful in the interpretation of data.
Now, how does that apply to forest health or how research is done in the forest with forest soils?
One of the four methods that we used for this one was mainly for forest soils. And the main difference is when you do for field crops, there's not that much organic matter in general. So if you took 10 grams of soil and 20 ml of water, you can make a slurry that we call 1:2. But if you took 10 grams of forest soil and 20 ml of water, it will all get soaked, and there you have to keep on adding more water. So you have to increase the ratio. So rather than 1:2, you have 1:4 or 1:5. And that's what we submit in the protocol. And that is the method we use for forest soils.
What's the significance, then, of all of this from an environmental perspective as it relates to forest soil condition?
Well, as you know, environmental pollution is one big thing. Acid rain we have been talking about for years. And pH is the negative log of hydrogen ion activity. So it indicates whether the soil pH is going up or down after a particular activity. So if you have a soil that you took from a particular area and the pH is 6.5, and a few years down the road, rather than 6.5, it comes down to 5.3, it has increased in acidity. The lower the value of pH, the higher the acidity. And it's not just a matter of by a small factor. When you have soil of pH 6 and pH 5, 5 doesn't look that much lower than 6, but it's 10 times lower in acidity. Each unit is, because it's a log, a negative log, it's 10 times. So from pH you can determine the effect of acid rain.
Well, it sounds like very important research. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That was Yasha Kalra, a soil chemist with the Canadian Forest Service. Another research project chosen as a finalist at the Emerald Awards was the Lower Kananaskis Lake Bull Trout Research, Management, and Education Program. Handling the research were biologist Dr. John Post of the University of Calgary and his master's student, Craig Mushins. As Craig explains, the problem began when bull trout in the lake had dwindled to a mere 60 fish.
Essentially, the project was initially started to try and understand or look at the recovery of a bull trout population that had been brought down in numbers due to overfishing. So essentially, back in 1995, regulations were changed to hopefully help the population recover. Since then, we've been monitoring the population each year by looking at the number of adults that are coming upstream to spawn and counting them and tagging them. And we also want to get more information on terms of the whole life cycle of the bull trout, because bull trout don't spawn until they're about 6 years old, which is quite old.
Whereabouts is this project taking place?
The project takes place in Lower Kananaskis Lake and Smith Dorian Creek, which is in Peter Lougheed Provincial Park in Kananaskis Country.
What are you finding?
Well, we've found since the changes in regulations, which were catch and release regulations and a bait ban on the lake, we have seen a recovery in the population from only 60 spawning adults, which was counted back in 1992, up to just this last summer to about 1,300 adults came upstream to spawn. So we've seen a drastic recovery of about 20 times as many over the last like 6 or 7 years.
How will you use this research?
Essentially, the research can be used in a number of different ways. The research can be used by fisheries managers in terms of assessing, looking at the survival rates and the life history of the bull trout population in terms of managing populations, figuring out what sizes bull trout set catch limits at, so bull trout can be caught and harvested possibly in the future. Another thing we've had very important within our project is we've had a larger educational aspect. We've had a lot of school groups and public actually come down to our site on tours and actually examine it and understand a lot more about the bull trout itself, and also just about the aquatic ecosystem.
What do you see as being the environmental significance?
Well, bull trout are a native species, and it's very important to show that with very little effort, really, by very simple changes in regulations, such as the bait ban and the catch and release regulations, we are able to help one of these populations recover, and this can be done in a lot of different areas, depending on the method of which the population was declined in the first place.
John, what do you see as being the bigger picture? How does this study fit into, say, larger programs that should be put into place?
Well, one of the goals of this particular project is just to learn more in general about the factors that affect the production of bull trout and other species for that matter, and how many are available for the angling public of the province. And it really is key to understand the biological productivity of the system before we can develop appropriate regulations, whether they be bag limits, the number of fish an angler can catch, or size limits, minimum sizes that anglers can harvest. And the goal of this project was at least in part to learn the appropriate management strategies to ensure that a population like Lower Kananaskis Lake is not reduced again to the 50 or 60 fish as it was less than a decade ago.
Who are the partners with this project?
Well, there are quite a number of partners. Key partners involve Alberta Fish and Wildlife personnel like Jim Stelfox, who we've worked with quite closely, and a couple of funding agencies. The Alberta Conservation Association and TransAlta Utilities have provided funding for this project.
Do you see this going further ahead?
Well, as we stand right now, the funding has been eliminated for the project, but we're really hopeful that we can develop new sources of funding so that we can continue this into the future. There really are a couple of key things we don't yet know, and that's the factors that control the survival of juveniles to the size and age at which they're then caught by anglers. And we're hopeful that a couple of years more of research on this particular population will help us with that. The other key area that we don't know well enough yet deals with the impact of anglers on the population and how many anglers and how much harvest is sustainable from a population like this. And part of the goal is to learn this specifically for this population, but overall we'd like to learn more about how you'd manage fisheries sustainably, not only bull trout in Lower Kananaskis Lake, but bull trout across the east slopes and other fish species that are overexploited across the province.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Craig, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Craig Mushins, a master's student in biological sciences at the University of Calgary. I also spoke with his supervisor, Dr. John Post. It was a tough choice, but the Emerald Award for Research and Innovation went to Dr. Walter Wilms for his years of research on rangeland ecology with Agriculture Canada.
Well, its primary thrust is in relation to conservation of the native prairie. I'm working both on the fescue grasslands as well as on the mixed prairie, and the objective is to try to maintain the integrity of that grassland while providing the rancher an opportunity to make a living from it.
What are some of the things that you've had to look at in order to do your research?
Well, on the fescue grassland, we're looking at a system of grazing that will help to preserve the grasses that are there. The primary grass is rough fescue. Now, this grassland was historically grazed by bison. We know that this grass is also extremely sensitive to summer grazing, but because the bison utilized in the wintertime, this grassland thrived and maintained its productivity very well. Now what we've done is put animals on in the summertime, and the question then becomes, how can you manage that, and what impact does the summer grazing have? And my predecessor, Alec Johnson, started a study in 1949 where he looked at the stocking rates. For example, grazing pressure has obviously a major impact on it. I took it one step further, and I looked at the historical aspect of grazing, and I said, well, why don't we put the cattle on here in the wintertime? And so what I've been trying to do is determine the economics and the ecological impacts of grazing the rough fescue grasslands in the wintertime. Obviously, in the wintertime, the quality is lower, and we need to look at some strategies that will make it beneficial or attractive to the rancher. And so that was one aspect of the research. On the mixed prairie, it seems to be somewhat different. The issue there is not the sensitivity of the grasses, but it is the productivity of the grasslands in relation to drought. We know that all these grasslands are impeded by water. Water is the primary limiting influence to productivity on these grasslands, but particularly so on the mixed prairie. Here we looked at the relationship that litter has, providing the cover and therefore a buffer for conserving water. And quite a bit of my work related to the impact of litter and therefore how should we be managing, and how does litter then define the condition of the grassland. We know that just by removing litter, we can, in fact, reduce the productivity by up to 60%, and that will depend on the amount of removal and the conditions that following the environment, weather conditions following removal.
Now, when you say litter, what do you mean?
Litter is the dead material that is left behind after grazing. The range community has essentially defined a rule of thumb that says you leave 50% of the grass behind at the end of the grazing season. Now, we never really knew what the role of that 50% was, whether it was to preserve energy in the crown of the grass or in the grass itself so it would allow regrowth the next year, whether it was basically a contribution to litter and therefore the conservation of water. And we, in fact, believe, I believe that the impact is primarily through conservation of soil water. And this has been one area of work that I've addressed over the last few years.
What response are you getting from the ranchers in these areas?
Thankfully, the extension of my work is through the public lands, and my associate in Lethbridge, Barry Adams, has been very effective in conveying this to the rancher. And my sense is that it has been received very well, and I think that the whole story of litter has been taken up by the ranchers. Those who are interested in learning more about managing their rangeland better.
What's the importance for these sorts of programs for conservation of the prairie grassland?
Well, I think there's twofold approaches that I alluded to. One is the production. The ranchers have to make a living off the ranges. We've also removed a lot of the influences that at one time provided disturbances to these grasslands. And so if we were just to leave them alone and allow them to revert to natural pressures, we probably wouldn't have the same conditions, the biodiversity, the things that we value, as we do with some animal impact. And so it is important to show that cattle, in fact, do have a role on the range, and to define that role and how to manage that role in a way that is going to provide both for the environmental community as well as the rancher the things that they value the most. The rancher is the security and also the environment. The environmental community wants to see an attractive grassland. We're looking at two different perspectives: the change in the species composition, and the change in the productivity. So we have both the environment and the production aspect that we need to address.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and it was my pleasure.
That was Dr. Walter Wilms, a rangeland ecologist with Agriculture Canada. He won this year's Emerald Award for Environmental Excellence in Research and Innovation. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.